give that shit up, you're going to concentrate on golf.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
You play ball like a girl!
Welcome to this week's edition of a Roy Orbison Tattoo Podcast with me, Colm, and my co-hosts, Bossy and Paul. This is the coaching podcast with a difference. We watch a movie, it might help if you watch it too, we get a special guest on, and we discuss the coaching from the movie and how it relates to our own experiences. So whether you're in the car, out for a run or a walk, or just using us to cancel out the noise from the kids in the background, we hope you enjoy.
Right, so welcome everybody. So this week we got Bossy and Paul as always. Welcome, lads.
How are y'all?
Well, how are things?
Very good. And I'd like to say we got Mr. Roland Sheen, down Intercounty Senior Hurling Manager, currently to join us this week. So welcome, Roland.
Thanks very much, lads. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks very much. Like, I suppose, look, first question we always ask is your background in coaching, and I suppose how you got into it, and what got you to where you are today as a coach.
I suppose born into it a wee bit in terms of my father. You know, I picked it all up off my father, really. So my father, we moved up from Bantyre and County Cork up here, almost 50 years ago now, more. And, you know, my father was involved in coaching teams and down there for years, you know. And I suppose I very much picked up from him that kind of love of the game and love of coaching. And, you know, we used to spend our summers, you know, even when we moved up here, we used to spend our whole summers down in Bantyre. And there was two men down in Bantyre had a real impact on me as well as a coach. You know, Teddy Fitzgerald and Kieran Foley. And what I took from those guys was they were always willing to coach teams even when their own kids weren't involved, you know, and they were always willing to kind of go out of their way. You know, they might have piled six guys into the back of the Ford Cortina to drive to Kilbrin or drive to, you know, Wheeling or whatever the case may be. But, you know, that gave me a kind of love and I suppose an understanding of the importance of passing the game on and passing it on to the next generation. And then I suppose, you know, from a more, you know, let's call it serious coaching perspective, I suppose I got involved in the development squads here in Down maybe 15 years ago, worked with them for a period of time, both minors, under 21s, development squads in general. And I suppose, to be fair, I probably fell into the Down senior job a wee bit by, you know, I wouldn't say by mistake, but, you know, I wouldn't be convinced that I'd been the first choice for it, if I'm being honest. You know, I think people probably felt, yeah, he's a good enough coach, he's done a good job of underage teams, etc. But there's no doubt that when Sean Hogan, Sean Rooney gave me the job, I'd say they were taking a bit of a punt on me, and I think others probably felt that as well, you know. So it was great to get that opportunity. But I think I really served my kind of time, for want of a better word, in development squads. Learned loads, you know, learned loads from them, learned loads from, I suppose, other coaches as well, and you know, was very lucky to be good friends with Damon O'Sullivan and Don Logue. And I think I've learned an awful lot from Sully in particular. And he obviously came up and helped us for a while in Down as well. So, yeah, an interesting journey, but one that was very shaped by my father, if I'm being honest, Colm, you know.
Yeah, very good. And now, do you know, when you were down in Bantyre during those summers, did you transfer down officially, or were you...
You know, I actually was talking about that to somebody, that, you know, God be with those kind of days when... you know, you could have gone down for the summer and there was no signing forms. And to be fair, you know, like every one of the clubs down there in the Hullen knew exactly that the Sheehans were home for the summer or whatever. There was never an objection. We always, you know, we played away and you know, they were fantastic times for us, you know. And there used to be a bit of a running joke in the Hullen, like if somebody was playing Bantyre, the first question they'd ask is, has the train arrived, you know, because obviously the train line went into down through Bantyre. But we had great times and some of the best memories from hurling have been with Bantyre. And, you know, thankfully we still have our house down there, we still go down there, and, you know, my own kids love it now, so it's down to the next generation again, you know. Although, to be fair, he hasn't played for Bantyre, we're keeping him legit and legal at the moment anyway.
Very good.
I saw you say, Ronan.
I think his accent now would be a wee bit kind of, it would definitely stand out.
Colm, I'll give you a good one, actually. I don't know if I ever told you this before. I actually spent a summer playing down in Cork as well at under 12 level. And my grandmother was in hospital and she actually passed away that summer. But we spent summer down in Cork and hurled for Blarney for a couple of weeks anyway.
Remember this, that?
Under 12s, you were about 16, right?
I don't know what age I was. But anyway, I heard it anyway. And the highlight was playing on the tiered pitches there in Glen Rovers.
Oh, yeah.
One of the days.
Yeah, but I think that's one of the things that, like, it was just taken as, Ayrshire, look, people, they're just playing, you know? It's not, like you said, Ron, there was no major objections. There was nothing like that. Like, it's just, like, and you mentioned the fellas you mentioned as well. I'm sure we can all think of fellas in our own clubs, and I'm thinking about the people now that did that, like, that once your kids are either you don't have kids or your kids are after outgrowing it, and they're the people that come back and give the kind of the time that there's no reward for other than they actually get to go down and spend time trying to help the next generation of hurlers and footballers. And they're crucial in every club. So I suppose it is something to see. But just going back on your appointment and down there, like you mentioned that, let's say you think you weren't the first choice. do you think that the fact, like, I suppose you'd see it an awful lot at the level that you'd be playing at, let's say below it, that there'd be an awful lot of high profile people given appointed to these posts with county teams, and a lot of the time it's based off their playing career and not their thing. Like, what do you think you've brought differently to Down, let's say, just having that local knowledge, that getting in Colin Crowley, Paul O'Brien from Dublin to come up and coach you, you know?
You know, don't get me wrong, because I think there is a real advantage of that. You know, so we got great value from the year that Dermot was involved in us and Sully was involved in us, you know. I think the bit for that, I think where it falls down, Colm, is when there is no local input. And what I mean by that is that, you know, if Down had an outside manager, for example, and they got beaten and they got relegated from Division 2B, the biggest concern for that manager probably is doesn't look good on my CV, and, you know, it's a disappointment on a personal level for them. I probably wouldn't talk to anyone for a month if I got Down relegated, you know, because it would really hurt me, because I've put so much time and effort into, you know, grassroots hurling here, whether it be my own club in Newry, or indeed kind of going and taking sessions in other clubs or helping other clubs. So I think, you know, when you've got that personal side to it, so I think, you know, I probably have a real passion for hurling in my own county. I know all of the guys. I've had most of these guys since, you know, at various levels. So Dahi Sands I've had since I'm 14, since he's been 14, you know. He's probably sick of me now at this stage. I wouldn't be sick of Dahi, because he's a great young fella and a great hurler, but he might be sick of listening to me. But I've, you know, there's probably no hurler in Down from under 13 up that I wouldn't really know, because I take almost every team in my own club. You know, so on a Friday night, you'll see me along the sideline at an under 13 game or an under 11 game or whatever. So, you know, I get to see a lot of the boys. I get to know them, and I think that there's that personal touch. Now, in saying that, I'm not adverse at all to bringing in people, and you know, let's say leaning on some of that expertise. You know, and indeed this year in Down, you know, we're very lucky. Ryan Dwyer's up helping us out this year, you know, and he's doing a good job with the guys. But it's getting that mixture right, Colm. I think sometimes when you bring, let's say, four lads and they're all have no connection to the county, I think it's questionable what value it can add at times, because, you know, they go, they leave in 2 years' time and they're not really worried about where Down hurling sits, or, you know, Wexford hurling, or say, you know, let's say Sligo hurling or whatever the case may be, you know, in those lower tiers. And I think, you know, it probably also brings up one of the, I suppose, bit of a talking point at the moment around bringing in outside players, you know, into the McDonagh Cup or into the kind of, you know, the Nicky Rackard or the Larry Maher or whatever the case may be. You know, outside managers are probably more likely to do that than a manager from within a county way, because, you know, they don't feel the same, I suppose, loyalty to lads that are in the county. They don't, you know, it's about winning in the next 2 years as opposed to winning over the next 10 or 15 years, you know, and it's an interesting debate, and it's probably one that's going to be debated, you know, quite vigorously now at Central Council in a couple of weeks, you know, because certainly from an Ulster perspective, you know, we probably get no players, you know, and it puts us at a disadvantage. And I'd also argue, I think for a Larry Maher or a Nicky Rackard, I can understand the logic of why you would do that. I think when you look at the likes of a Kildare or, you know, a Laois or a Down or a Westmeath, who are putting effort into their underage structures, you know, why wouldn't you give your own kids a chance instead of bringing somebody else in? But it's very easy for me to speak because I'm not in that situation where I'm not bringing anybody in. But I do think it is more likely to happen with outside managers than it is with homegrown managers, for want of a better word.
And sorry, Paul, go on.
And Ronan, you talked about winning in the next year or two, or winning in 10 to 15 years. Mm. And like, you're looking at the longer term aspect of it. And as someone who's come through the development squad system, and now we'll say the figurehead as the county manager, right? Mm. Have you still any, we'll say, branches or routes back down into, or any say in what's happening down the way?
Oh yeah, look, I wouldn't say I've got say, so to speak. So I wouldn't kind of overplay my hand. But yeah, I would still. So I take the under 20s as well. But you know, for example, I ran an under 13 scheme this year, so we had about 80 kids involved in it, where we didn't pick anybody. You know, we just said to the clubs, look, send everyone you have, and we'll coach them. And I did that. So it was we called it Better Together. So we had 80 under 13s in and down, which is good numbers for down. But you know, I had my senior squad to help me as well. So the way that we ran it was, you know, every week, two or three players from the senior squad came and helped with the coaching. Other guys came. So Sully came and did a day for me. You know, Tony Austin, Mick Blair, guys that are involved in the senior county team came and did it. Did a couple of days as well, you know. And the feedback from the kids, the feedback from the parents was fantastic. You know, we finished off with a blitz. To be fair, I stole that idea from Cork around creating four or five, you know, teams, you know, that are not so much regional based, you know, but within the county, and played them off in a wee blitz under lights in Park Esther, which is our county ground. But you know, that went down really, really well. And I think, you know, I see there, I follow some of the guys obviously in Cork and other places, and I think those kind of wee blitzes, and you see them playing them at regional level at under 14, etc., I think are fantastic. You know, there's too much focus sometimes on lads being on a county team at under 14 or a county team at under 15. And you know, we're not focusing enough on, you know, the fact that a lad at 13, 14 might well slip through the net, but, you know, because he hasn't got the physical attributes at that moment in time. But, you know, he has the commitment, he has the skill level, and as they all get bigger and stronger, well, then you'll actually find that he's the man that ends up on the county senior team. And I certainly have three or four of those on my county senior panel at the moment, guys that never really started underage, but are mainstays of the county team now.
Pretty good.
Not sure if that answers your question, Paul, but yeah, I do have.
No, it does.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't try and impose myself either, if that makes sense, to say, well, I'm the county manager, so I should be able to say A, B, and C. But yeah, I'm very much involved in the underage structures in the county and trying to get it, because ultimately, you know, what is the senior team but simply a factor of what you've done at underage, or what the work that you're doing at underage. You don't do the work at underage, well, then your senior team will fall down, and you know, you might get one or two good years or two or three good years, but you won't produce at a consistent level at senior. And unfortunately, you know, probably Cork over the years, you know, probably paid the price of that. Now, they've obviously got their underage structures going well again, but you know, I was just saying to Sully this year before the All-Ireland final, you know, when I was Oisin's age, you know, Oisin's just turning 10, you know, I had already seen Cork win three in a row, you know, and you know, he's coming 10. He's never seen Cork win an All-Ireland. Tierna's coming 14, and she hasn't either, you know. So I think there's a big piece there to be said that, you know, it all has to work together for it to be successful. And if you don't do it at underage, you won't see it at senior. And I think Dublin are another great example of that, because when I was playing minor for Down, we were playing Dublin, you know, and competing with them. You know, if I brought my minor team down to Dublin now, they wouldn't compete. You know, Dublin have pushed on so much, which is great to see as the capital city and the biggest kind of population on the island. But I think it is indicative of the fact that you get your underage structures right and it will flow through to senior level. You don't do that and you put everything into your senior pot, and you know, you might get success for a couple of years, but it will fall away eventually.
Very good. And just on your under 13 or 14 thing you said you did, I remember on Twitter, I think you put up a picture of them all sitting in the stand and they all had a nice little jersey on them.
Yeah, they all had a wee jersey on them. Yeah, we all had a top. The county provided them with a top, and they provided kind of coffee and stuff and that there for the parents that night as well that came, you know, and stuff. So yeah, look, it, it was great, you know. And like Colin, we're under no illusion as to where we are and down in terms of the pecking order and hurling and the work that we have to do, etc. But you know, to get 80 kids playing hurling on a regular basis over 6 weeks, 7 weeks as it was fantastic, you know. And hopefully we're building that now at under 15, etc., etc.
Yeah, because I can know when Dublin kind of started their hurling revolution back in the mid-noughties, I think that was one of the things that they, it was the attraction that they used, was that you get the gear, you get the gear bag, you get the jersey, you get the hoodie, whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. They looked apart when they were going out representing the county, as opposed to just being the number two code within the county. Mm-hmm. But I said, look, I know you're making great strides, but come on, look, we better get on with the movie. Tell us what you chose and why you chose it.
Yeah, look, I suppose, well, part of the reason I chose it was that a couple of the first suggestions I made were already taken. But yeah, look, I probably was torn between two kind of for this. So I was considering, as you know, Colin, putting in kind of The Road to Lisbon, because I'd be a big Celtic fan. I think there's a great story to be told there around, you know, the all of the guys being bored within 20 miles of the stadium, etc. Unfortunately, that particular documentary probably doesn't focus an awful lot on Jock Stein and his coaching style and things. It's more around the fans and so on. So I probably didn't think it would be appropriate for this. So we then picked one around, it's called Blood and Glory. And I suppose the premise of it is that it's set in a prisoner of war camp or a concentration camp, as it is, in terms of the Boer War, with a group of prisoners. And I suppose, look, people have seen this before, maybe Escape to Victory and similar type kind of films. But the one that this struck me with was that there were a number of really key coaching points in it, or points around coaching, that I felt you were able to kind of focus in and discuss. And I think, you know, particularly being, when I'm interested in all Gaelic sports and played both, you know, hurling's my prime game. And I think there's a real one that struck me, and that was around the innovation in the game, you know. And there's a piece in the film, you know, where the Boers, one of the Boers players, William Morkel, turns around and says, you know, well, why can't we pick it up? You know, and the manager, you know, Finn, the Irishman that's helping them, says, because that's the way the game's played, you know. And if you think back to, you know, back into the 2000s, when Cork started the possession game and the running game initially, and you had all these people almost looking to kind of, you know, nail Donal O'Grady to a cross and kind of saying he's ruining the game, you know, and it's like basketball. And then you look now at the way the game's evolved, you know, you look at Derek McGrath, players and people like that, that brought in a sweeper and that, you know, and people saying that's not hurling, you know. And for those of us that grew up in the 70s and 80s and, you know, and saw kind of, you know, or even you go back and you watch TG Cahir Gold, you know, and you watch the games from the 1970s or the 80s, it is a very different game. But it doesn't mean that innovation is wrong or that innovation isn't good, you know. And I think that was a real, you know, I felt that was something that struck me while watching that. And I think there's another couple of other key points in it around kind of talented players and trying to get them to commit, you know, player leadership and playing for a cause. So I thought there's an awful lot in the film that relates to coaching. And I also think it's a great story, you know, and it probably marries two things that I kind of are very interested in, sport and history. And I think, you know, when you look at that film in particular, Blood and Glory, and, you know, it takes the, you know, it probably plays a wee bit on the Springboks or the origins of the Springboks. You know, you'll argue that it wouldn't be the most historically correct, but it also links to another really kind of impactful film in terms of Invictus, and, you know, how sport was used there to unite the Rainbow Nation in very difficult times as they came out of the apartheid. You know, so I think the film itself shows the importance that sport can play in general life as well. So, you know, some great coaching points in it, but I think it's actually a very good film as well to watch and to enjoy.
I actually never heard of the film until you mentioned it there a couple of weeks ago, and I didn't know what to expect. When I heard Blood and Glory, I thought it was going to be kickboxing or something like that. I didn't know. And I sat down and watched it, and this, like I said, the start of it was a tough watch, but really got into it. It was like a real darker version of, say, Mean Machine. Remember? There's a lot of parallels, but it's a great story to it. And as you say, there is some very delicate coaching points in it that were really interesting, and like the player development and decision making and what players see when they're actually on the pitch rather than being the coach telling them what to do all the time. Because as we often say, like ideally, if players can come up with the solution, it's probably better to be told what the answer is. And I thought that was one of the better coaching points of the film, but it's a great film. It's absolutely, definitely recommend it.
Yeah, like that's saying around, that's the way the game is played. Like Finn, the fella from Tip, like he said that it was only the third time that it was said to him in the film that he went, right, you know what, players, you take responsibility for this. Because like, as they were getting to know the game and start playing the game, and William Forrest said it, he was like, no, just like, that's the way the game is played. But as they grew and evolved, and like, it was great because when it was in the match, and it allowed their, we'll say their strengths that they developed as people and characters as Boers. And like the fact, you know the scene when they talked about who they are and where they're from, and there was teachers and there was doctors and there was students, and there was like everyone had a different profession, and they were coming from all different areas, different mentalities, etc. And they brought that onto the pitch when they got there, you know. And it shows, like, and Finn, like when Finn talked about, he said the out half for the English, and he previously played
against Butler, yeah
and he was class. And you know, and like he was class. It was just, oh, shite, there's nothing we can do about it. Whereas he was very much stuck in his ways. We can only solve a problem one way, and if we can't solve the problem that way, the problem can't be solved. Whereas we learn throughout it that the problems can be solved in different manners, you know?
Yeah, and I think there's a really, during the game, when they actually decide that they're going to play the Boer way, in inverted commas, he's on the sideline, and one of the other guys says to Finn, you know, what do you think? You know, when they've decided they're going to go, and he says, well, it's out of my hands, you know. And I kind of say that to my team quite a bit, you know, that when they walk onto the field or they cross onto the white line, yeah, I can make a few substitutions or I can make a few moves or whatever, but actually, if they really have to take ownership and it's out of my hands at that stage, you know, like, okay, I could have them prepared, I can give them parameters. And I'm a big believer in giving players a set of parameters or a context in which they play within, but actually they need to make the decisions on the ball, because you can see it all the time in matches, you know, both in your own games or indeed when you're watching the telly or whatever, where teams are almost paralyzed because they've been hard-coded to do certain things with the ball or to play in a certain way. And the minute that breaks down, then the whole thing falls down, because the players haven't been given the freedom to, you know, play, you know, the game as it evolves in front of them or play what's in front of them. And, you know, that's why I'm a big fan of, you know, putting players in the situations, whether it be in coaching or you know, whether it be in training or in matches, where they have to think for themselves, you know, and they have to take the leadership. Because if you think about who you are as a coach or who you are as a manager, you're really only a custodian. So it doesn't matter if you're a club or you're at a county or whatever, you're only there for a period of time, maybe 2 years, maybe 4 years, whatever the case may be. But actually, you know, what you want to do is build a culture within the group of players where they take ownership, that they are the leaders, that they demand the standards, in inverted commas. And, you know, when you look at that final kind of 10 minutes, 15 minutes of the game in Blood and Glory, it was the players that dictated the pace. It was the players that dictated the change in tactics. And it was the players that effectively won the match, you know. And I think there's a lot to be learned from that in modern coaching, I think.
Yeah, but and how do you equip the players to take that kind of leadership and that responsibility and culture that you talked about? Like, what can you do for that? Like, what have you any examples?
Yeah, I think there's a few things, Colm. I think one is you pick the right players, you know, and in terms of, you know, within your squad and within your panel, and you know, you try to create a smaller, or certainly the way I've done it in the past is I've tried to create a smaller leadership groups, you know. And I think some of this stuff can be can unfortunately turn into tick box stuff, or indeed kind of, you know, oh, being seen as a bit of a fad. But I do, I'm a real believer in leadership groups, you know, and picking three, four, five leaders within a group, building another five or six players around them in their wee group, and that they hold each other accountable. I think, you know, when you look at even that, if you even look at the fact of Daniel, when he came back to play in Blood and Glory, Daniel didn't come back to play because Finn, the coach, got onto him or was constantly saying to him, play, play, play. He came back because of an event that happened to one of his teammates or to somebody that he knew. So it was really that peer pressure event that actually changed kind of Daniel's mind to come back and play. And I think, you know, players have the biggest influence on other players as opposed to coaches in terms of getting them to raise their standards, particularly off the pitch and things like that. In terms of getting them prepared to make their own decisions on the field of play, I think it's very much around, you know, what you do in training. You know, so having, you know, games that make the players make a decision under pressure. And the more often you put them into that situation, the more comfortable they become in that situation. Now, it might be as crude as saying, well, lads, you know, we're going to put an extra bit of extra pressure on today that, well, the team that wins, lads, is back next, is back in 2 days' time with Stu, our strength and conditioning guy, doing extra work or whatever. You know, so you do try and put a wee bit of pressure on it as well and make it real life. But I think, you know, you put them under the thing of saying, well, actually, we're going to play 7v6 and the team that's kind of seven needs to score 6 points in the 10 minutes or whatever the case may be. You know, you put those kind of conditions, put them under pressure, you know, make them make decisions when they're under pressure as often as possible so that when they go onto the field, they start to make those instinctively as opposed to thinking. Because we've all played with a player or we've all seen the player where you can almost see the brain slowing down to say, I'm going to pick the ball, I'm going to run around the man, I'm going to strike the ball. You know, you've got to be at a pace. And the only way to do that is, you know, putting them in game situations, forcing them to make decisions and making the decision count. And what I mean by that is that it's very hard to replicate real match conditions because there's more pressure in a real match, whether it be McDonagh Cup, McCarthy Cup or whatever. You can't replicate that to the same degree. What you can do, though, is make it to put them into a situation where they're under a level of pressure, whereby they handle pressure, but that the next action that they take with the ball becomes so instinctive, they don't have to think about it. So when you put them into the highly pressurized environment, it doesn't really matter because all they're doing is playing on instinct, or they're playing, you know, it's almost a, that doesn't matter the environment, doesn't matter the pressure, they just know to do the right thing with the ball at that time. If that makes sense, Cole.
Yeah. Yeah, and just go back on one of the things you mentioned there as well, Ron, about, or I think, Paul, you actually mentioned about when he was asking, who are you and what do you do? Like, one of the things that I kind of think I've seen over the last generation would be the rushing of players to get to the pitch and get away from the pitch. You know, that a lot of the time, players are arriving now in the car, tugged out. Well, they are now because of COVID, obviously, but even before COVID, they're arriving at 25 past seven for a half seven training session, onto the pitch, pick puck around, and then after training session, back into the car, you know. And like, I always use the example of the dressing room, and, you know, like, that's where you really get to know people. But, like, do you feel, like, and you can all talk about this, lads, like, do you feel that we've lost a small bit of that internal kind of natural communication that has kind of developed over the last kind of 10, 15 years, like, from when we were, let's say, breaking onto the scene, us young bucks were breaking onto the scene 15 years ago?
Like, what's the first thing you see when someone goes back in the dressing room now after a training session? What's the first thing they nearly all do? They want their phone to check any messages.
The bloody phones, yeah.
The bloody phones. Like, that's like, what can we do about it? They go straight onto the phones, and it's the same. I said it before, you're driving in the car and you look past the bus stop, you see 10 people waiting at the bus stop sitting down, they're all with their heads down, looks like their phones. And it's just the whole communication thing is it's changing, the dynamic is changing. There's definitely things that we can do as management teams and groups of players to try to help with players getting to know each other, like something we did before the team was involved with over in Cardiff there. After one session, we had a little barbecue. Someone brought down portable barbecue, had someone cooking there who was injured at the time. I actually think it was my wife who came down. She was doing the sausages on the sideline. End of the session, we all stayed in behind the trees and we chatted for about half an hour. And it was brilliant. And people just got to know each other casually and had a bit of crack and a bit of banter. And it's just like little things. I remember it was involved with a team there not so long ago. We were playing a challenge match. And the team we were playing against, it was a younger team we were playing against. And all their parents brought down sandwiches and buns and cakes. And they put on a big spread in the hall after the match. And both teams went in. And we're in there for half an hour just talking to each other, getting to know each other. And I didn't see any phones on site that night because people were actually talking. They had their tea in one hand or sandwich in the other and had to use their mouth to communicate. And I think it's all about getting to know people, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really helps.
Yeah, and I think look, COVID has caused a bit of a challenge in terms of dressing rooms. There's no doubt about that, you know, and the camaraderie. Now, we're back in them now. We didn't use them at all, probably. So we played our league final against Derry in October 2020, with, you know, right at that, you know, and from that period, the whole way through last year, we never used dressing rooms once. Now, we were very lucky in that period when we were playing in October and November. Believe it or not, it never rained on a Tuesday or Thursday. It was just one of those real flukes, you know, because it was something that was concerning me to say, do I not use the changing rooms and put them back in the cars soaking wet, or, you know, but struck luckily on that. But last year we never used them either, you know. We were in this, you know, we were down to Kerry twice last year to play them, both in the league and the McDonagh Cup, and, you know, using two buses and everybody masked up on the buses and, you know, sitting every fourth seat, and, you know, the lads all having to you know, single rooms and all of that kind of stuff, you know. So very, very different to some of the camaraderie that you would have seen or whatever. But this year we're back in, you know, now we're working again on the basis that it's eight men to, you know, we have four dressing rooms, eight men to a dressing room, and it's the same men, every, you know, all of the, trying to make sure that you kind of can isolate, for want of a better word, if you have an outbreak. But I do think, you know, the phones, something that I did, we went down one time on a training weekend with our under-17s, actually, our Celtic Challenge team and our minors, the year we won it, we went down to UL for the weekend, and we came over to Carlow for the final and stuff. But we took the phones off them. They all had to put the phone into the bag when they got on the bus, and they were told that they could have the phone back at night to answer any texts or any phone calls from their parents, and then they had to give it back to us again, you know, and that we were holding on to them or whatever. And, you know, on our senior team now, on our senior buses, if we're going somewhere, you know, we would have the usual card sharks at the back, and they're allowed to let them go on. We don't play for the last 45 minutes an hour before we come towards where we're stopping. They would stop, but, you know, the card sharks, generally I don't let them put the beats or anything on their earphones until they're 45 minutes out from the venue or whatever. The try and not force them to communicate, but, you know, as much as you can, you know, try and build that camaraderie where they're, you know, need to look, when you know somebody personally, when you know someone's backstory, when you know enough about that person to invest in them, well, then you'll generally go to war for that person. But if that person is just a passing acquaintance who happens to be kind of, you know, so if I think about the people I know at work, and I work with some great people or whatever else, you know, but ultimately most of the people I work with are acquaintances, not friends. And there's a real difference, you know, between those, you know. And I think on a hurling field and in a hurling panel or a football panel or whatever, what you want to create as much as you possibly can is that environment whereby everyone is invested in each other, and they are invested to the extent that their work, that they are concerned for John McManus, the person, as opposed to just John McManus, the player, as an example, as one of my people. You know, takes time to get there, doesn't always work, but I think it's something that's worth investing in, because a group of players that are invested in each other will always outperform a group of players that aren't.
Very good. Just, and also on the film, like, the, I suppose, like, one of the things, like, they started the plane for a cause, and, you know, it's something that I suppose you could see used positively and negatively, it could have a positive result or a negative result at times, but like, it can be a great way of uniting a group and getting people to perform when used in the correct context, like.
Oh, absolutely. It's massive. You know, like, you know, we'll all have grown up in the times of the man breaking the hurley off the dressing room before he went out on the pitch and things like that. Yeah, but it's an interesting one, Colin, because, you know, I suppose I have personal experience of this in the context that, you know, we have a young lad in our club who died when he was 16. Now he's dead 11 years now, but my own young fella, Oisin, is actually named after him, you know. You know, we would be very conscious of Oisin McManus in our own club when we play. So, for example, we won the Intermediate Championship this year for the first time since the mid-80s. And the first place we went afterwards was to the was to Oisin's grave with the cup, you know, and things like that. However, we don't talk about him in the dressing room. So we don't get into the context of we're going to win this for Oisin or, you know, things like that. That can become a real rallying point for teams, and I've seen it for teams. But it can also become a real deflation whereby players feel so much pressure to perform for that individual's memory and more particularly for the family of that individual that it actually becomes crippling, you know. So it's an interesting one. I've seen it happen in both, you know, both contexts. I've seen it work, and I've seen it also, you know, absolutely deflate a team word to the extent that they almost were paralyzed by the fear of losing because they felt they were letting down that individual. So, you know, you need to be very careful about the when you invoke that, whether the team that you're dealing with have the mental fortitude to deal with that pressure and handle that pressure accordingly. You know, I think identity as a team, identity as a group of players is absolutely massive. But I think that's very different than playing for a cause or making it all about the cause as opposed to making it about the group and how the group are the best version of themselves. But it is an emotive subject. And listen, we see it in the GAA all the time with the tragedies that happen in clubs or in counties. And, you know, let's do it for Oisin or let's do it for such and such. It would be interesting to hear what the other guys think. But I think it's something that can become almost destructive if your group isn't mentally resilient and mentally strong.
Yeah, Roland, do you know a factor in it and how it plays out actually stems back to what we were talking about before, about them actually getting to know each other and, like, did they, like, and not to say labour on Oisin as an individual.
Yeah, no, straight, yeah.
But, like, do, if someone passed away and he was an integral part of the group and he got on well with people and he shared his ups and downs with the people within the group, then it can be something that's really strong for the group. But if that's just a transient person who's in the group but isn't a pivotal figure or could take or leave being part of the group and the group isn't a particularly strong unit, then yes, it mightn't be the motivating factor that it needs. And it is something that's really delicate. And sometimes when, and how you mentioned Oisin there, he's not mentioned, but then in the aftermath, it's going to the grave. That's nearly where it's possibly strongest, that it doesn't need to be talked about. Something that's really strong and really motivating doesn't need to be labored and pointed out all the time, because it's there, everyone's aware of it, and it's part of it. Like,
yeah, like, and we often talk about it. You know, we talk about it not before games and stuff, but after games, or, you know, we'll often reference the fact that, you know, the group is, you know, always feels his hand on our shoulder when we go out onto the pitch and stuff, you know, and he is very much part of the group. But I think, you know, because of the character he was, and because of, you know, how ingrained in the group he is, or he was, you know, obviously, and still is, it is one of those unspoken things. You know, we you know, that it doesn't kind of need spoken about, that we'll go to his grave the minute we want. You know, it was just first, you know, and it wasn't me. You know, I'm kind of the older group in that dressing room, even though I'm still playing at 49. But, you know, it was young lads, you know, like Sean Campbell, who's only 20 and wouldn't really have played a fashion. And it was Sean Campbell that said in the dressing room straight after the match, said, first place that's cup needs to go to Oisin's grave. You know, so, you know, it can be a very powerful thing. But I've also seen it, and I've had personal experience whereby you know, we've tried to, as a club and not Shamrocks, but in Bantier, where we've latched on to, you know, a tragic passing away, but, you know, it's almost, I wouldn't say backfired, because all of the motivations were there for the right reasons, but just didn't work out, and actually ended up almost paralyzed. You know, the team were almost in paralysis because they were just worried about not performing, and they ended up not performing, you know, like it's a bit of Sod's law, you know.
I would think that a lot of management teams wouldn't have the experience of dealing with something like that if something tragically happened. And you'd want to be very, very careful the way you handle that straight away if something happens like that. Touch wood, never that I can think of something like that I've been had to use, or I've been involved in a team that something happened in that event. But like, if you're a manager or a mentor, maybe ring somebody and ask them how did you deal with it. Because if you go in and set the wrong tone, it could backfire fairly, fairly quickly. So it's just maybe pull back from it for a bit, find out what other teams dealt with it, and go about the best way you possibly can. But it's something that it's, touch wood doesn't, I don't have to deal with myself personally.
Sorry, Ronan, go on.
Yeah, but I think, you know, if you look at that, if you look at the film, again, it was the players that set the tone about the cause they were going to play for, and the fact that they, you know, and in many ways, you know, the young fella that was up for execution, in inverted commas, you know, they rallied round William's decision. You know, William made the decision that he was willing to take the leadership and to step up and say, look, we're going to play this game, and if we lose, I'll take his place, in inverted commas. And the players actually rallied to William and rallied to his decision to show leadership. And he became almost the cause, as opposed to the young lad who was initially up for execution. So I think sometimes in difficult situations like that, it's leadership from within the group that can set the tone for everything.
Yeah, and I suppose it was one of the later scenes was the, I suppose we mentioned it in the first episode of the season with David Sharkey about teaming, but the name Springboks was essentially, unless I'm getting it very wrong, that they use visualization of what the Springbok is about, being loyal and stay certainly in, and you know, you kind of set the tone of what they expected themselves of as a group. And look, as I said, I know we had David Sharkey on talking about it, but it was actually just, it was teaming, but it was only 30 seconds long teaming, but it just put in place a sort of a stamp on what their expectations as individuals and as a group, this is what they wanted, which I thought was very powerful, like the way he spoke about it and the story behind it. So I just think that was very good. And I suppose it's something that was, I suppose it was something they clung to, and obviously, said whatever about the historical accuracy of it, but it was something good.
Yeah, no, like it was one of the most powerful parts of it.
Another thing I liked in it was, so obviously they were prisoners during the daytime, and they were carrying out the duties that they needed to carry out and getting them done. But the fact that they were a group and they were doing that together, and there's a bit of a, we'll say, away at a training camp or what you get with in a school team or whatever, there was elements of that. A lot of the strength of the team came from what they were doing outside of the training, but there was also the element of, like, when they were doing their duties and they were getting rocks from point A to point B, they were working on their passing, and there was just a few small little things like that. And thinking of, we'll say young hurlers or young footballers, like, what can you do during your day-to-day life that can replicate what you need to do in football or hurling to improve? And like, if you can get a small little bit of that done, it can be and build it into your normal life, it can be helpful as well, you know?
You know, funny, I had a few notes jotted down there Oh, I had exactly the same thing down about that bit. You can, when they're all on the line and they're all passing the like the rugby ball, but and you actually think about it, what is that in the context? But something like fundamentals, where you teach people the actual basics of the game without them even knowing that they're practicing the basics of the game. So if you look at, you know, if you take some of the examples that are out there at the moment around, you know, putting a Superman theme in nurseries and you know, and using kind of Thor's hammer, what effectively is only, you know, one of the wee small hurleys and balancing the kind of the beanbag on it or whatever the case may be. But you're giving the kids something they can relate to, you know, Thor, whatever, you know, and balancing the, you know, and it's a fundamental, but it's a fundamental skill of the game. The same way that they were passing the rock from one to another, but actually they were, you know, and I think that was one of the things that I kind of said about Finn as a coach, that, you know, he definitely would have had deficiencies in other areas. But if you think about what he did, you know, the first thing, okay, again, the suggestion initially came from one of the players, let's have the sports day. But then he was able to say, well, actually, I'll use that sports day to identify the physical attributes and the players and what position they'll go into. And he then very cleverly started to use the manual labor that they were being forced to do to actually hone their technical skills. You know, and I think it's one of the big challenges for us, you know, particularly when you move to, you know, senior club or inter-county and stuff, and you start to talk about, you know, game-based conditions and playing short-sided games and playing conditioned games. And most of your training session will generally be round games. You know, even the best hurlers and the best footballers have technical deficiencies. You know, and, you know, I was sort of funny, I was just watching some of our videos there where we played the McGurk Cup, the three matches in it so far. And, you know, I was looking just at a couple of the players in terms of slow-mo, in terms of how they're striking the ball and leaning back slightly. You know, that's a kind of technical issue, and yet you're trying to kind of coach, you know, let's call them an elite athlete on the technical side. But I think, you know, at times we're in danger of losing out on the necessity to coach the technical skills as well, you know, and it's something that sometimes is overlooked. Because I think if we all looked at the video, even a video today of the Walsh Cup match or whatever else, I have no doubt that we'd pick out four or five technical deficiencies of players that could be worked on, you know. And you know, I'll say something controversial now, you know, the greatest hurler of them all, Christy Ring, you know, still worked on his kind of technical skills, you know, and the, you know, the ball and the wall. And I know that the wall ball, myself and Colin were part of a discussion on Twitter last year about how useful it was or not. But you know, there is a place for technical skills and technical coaching still, very much so, even at the elite level. And I think that's one of the things that I thought Finn was good at, was that he was able to bring that technical coaching into the everyday, you know, run of the mill stuff that they had to do as part of the prison, you know.
Bit like Mr. Miyagi or Daniel LaRusso.
Yeah, exactly. It's the one you think of.
Wax on, wax off.
Wax on, wax off, yeah.
Pretty good. Was there anything else in the movie, lads, that you thought that you just want to just bring up? Any other topics or aspects?
Yeah, the whole imperialism and colonialism, and that, how do British people watch films and think, geez, we had a great history? They just come across desperate. Like, yeah. Your man, the prison officer? Or sorry, the...
Wally, Colonel Swally, yeah.
Yeah, he was like one of the most hated characters I think I've ever seen in a film. Yeah. He was just a horrible, horrible person.
Yeah, but I think, look, you know, I think one of the things that I find about that film is that, you know, sport's a great unifier. You know, and it has real massive potential. And, you know, a couple of years ago, we lost the Christy Ring final, you know, and on the weekend of Bloody Sunday, actually, you know, and we were there and I spoke to our guys. We went down afterwards to Lea Reef after we got beaten with the weight, until Kildare left, but it wasn't the easiest weight. But we went down, we led the reef, and I was just talking to the guys afterwards. And I just made the point around, you know, when you looked around you at that stadium, when you looked at how it had been built from the ashes, and, you know, the fact that we were lucky that we had inherited such a fantastic stadium. And I think, you know, what I said to them was that, you know, the GAA and the organization we were part of had played such a massive role in those formative years of, you know, the revolutionary years or the formation of the of the Republic of Ireland, but you know, whatever you want to refer to. But I actually think that it has an awful, and I said this on the day, it has a big role to play in the next 50 years in civic society and helping to, you know, smooth the path of reconciliation and kind of, you know, unifying people around sport. And I think, you know, we should never lose, you know, sight of that, is that sport in itself can bring out the worst of us at times, but it also brings out the very, very best of us in terms of giving us something that we can unify about. And you can see that in counties and in clubs and, you know, when the championship win comes, you know what? And I think, you know, as an organization in particular, you know, when is the GAA at its best? Probably in tragedy. You know, when you see tragedy around clubs and all, you know, when does it really step up? When does it become? And I think that's one of the things that I took from the film as well, you know, is around the importance of sport to people and what it means to people, and the fact that it can mean that it's just far more than the game, you know. And I think anyone that's involved in coaching will always say that it's not just a sport, you know, it's a vocation in many ways.
Yeah, I completely agree with you.
Excellent. Ronald, I think we'll leave it on that. I don't think we could have ended any better. Well said on all that. Look, I'm sure, look, you're vocal in your thoughts and stuff like that. Like, and it's great to see it. But I suppose, look, we're all trying to move forward to a better place, regardless of what differences are there at the moment and stuff like that. But no, fair play. Ronald, thanks very much for your time. Much appreciated.
Not at all. Delighted. Thanks so much.
Winner down out in the league and the thing, are you going to win it all this year?
So we're out. We play Carlo on the 6th of February. So we're with the McGurk Cup final here on Wednesday night, which is probably run our kind of, let's call our back panel in that very much. And then we're away to Tipperary this weekend for a training weekend coming up, and play Leash and we play Tipperary and stuff. So, yeah, looking forward to that. I will not make any predictions because the margins of error in Division 2A and the McDonagh Cup are wafer thin, which is brilliant, you know, and it's fantastic. And you know, I think it's a pity it isn't publicised more, because there's a good standard of hurling there. And I said it on the fixtures committee when we were talking about the football at the time, and I said to Larry and Tom that, you know, the Tailteann Cup could be a great competition if it's profiled properly. But my concern would be it's going to end up at the McDonagh Cup and, you know, the Christie Ring and stuff, and get no publicity whatsoever. But, you know, look, we'll keep on fighting the good fight. And, you know, as I said, it's a great standard, and hopefully more people get to see it over the next couple of years.
Yeah, it's really, really disappointing, the coverage it gets, because there's not too many competitions where there's six teams entering it and any of the six teams could win it.
Well, yeah.
And any of the six teams could get relegated.
That's exactly right. Like, you know, you look last year, I'll give you a prime example. Like, Kildare did really well last year. They obviously had beaten us in the Christie Ring the year before. You know, they lost like by 2 points to Kildare, and maybe lost by 2 points or 3 points to Westmeath and relegated. And like we ended up not getting to the final simply based on goals scored. With the same points as Kerry, with the same points scored, with the same score difference, but they'd scored two goals and we'd only scored one. And as a consequence, they went through the so the margins are wafer thin. And, you know, let's be honest, what are the best competitions? Best competitions are when things are competitive, and, you know, that's, I think there's some cracking hurlers, you know, Marty Kavanagh, you know, Tommy Doyle, you know, Shane Conway. They'd be, you know, if they were anywhere else, they'd be, you know, if they were living in Cork or Limerick or whatever, they'd be on those panels too. So it's a pity people don't get to see them, because there's some special talents playing, not only just in the McDonagh Cup, but in the Christie Ring and the other competitions as well.
So you got Ryan Dwyer up anyway this year to solve
we've up to give us a bit of a hand. Yeah, to be fair to him. Now he's boys are taking well to him, you know. So look, listen, they'll you know, you learn something from everybody. And I think, you know, as I've said, Paul, you know, I think when you marry it with local people, in inverted commas, in terms of the background stuff, it works really, really well, because that exposure to the higher level and what it takes. I think, you know, the guys are very hungry for it, if that makes sense. They're mad keen to learn from him, etc. And it adds real values. Yeah, so looking forward to it.
Brilliant. Best of luck with Ronan, and thanks again
for your time. No problem.
Thanks, Ronan. Thank you.
We are into season 5 now, so thanks to everyone who has listened so far. We would be grateful if you would take the time to give us a retweet on Twitter or just share it with your friends.
It would also be great if you give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It would mean a lot to us and we really appreciate it. Hope you all had a great week and we'll talk to you next week. See you next week, everybody.